Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I'd like to welcome you. This is going to be one of those hours that you're going to get a real interesting balance of information, the latest on health and healing. For instance, we're going to talk about how curcumin and resveratrol and your salicylic acid are good for prostate cancer, something positive for the men in the audience who suffer from that or know someone who does. Vitamin C and antibiotics, a 1-2 punch for knocking out cancer stem cells, University of Stanford in their biomedical research division, also University of Texas. And we're talking about poor diet and Alzheimer's gene can fuel disease, University of Southern California. I would say there's a lot we can do to prevent that from happening. I'll share what we can do. Also, a plant-based diet boosts weight loss twice as effectively as traditional diabetes diets from the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. And also, research finds a link between spacing out and giving up. University of Waterloo, low levels of vitamin A may fuel TB risk, Harvard Medical School. Why is that important? Because in the summertime, a lot of people like to travel to exotic places, the Far East, Africa. And it's good to do that, to learn the cultures, to see the people. In fact, many people to donate and contribute some time and energy. But you're also susceptible to TB. Having that right amount of vitamin A in your body could help prevent that. But then the second part of our program, and I'm devoting almost a half hour to it, is a look at the climate. First, I'm going to have a person that I would personally consider climate denier on. Very articulate, sounds reasonable, and the information presented sounds accurate, except it isn't. But the person you're going to hear, you've rarely heard him. He is going to be on from England via Skype. He is Professor Peter Wadham. He is Professor of Ocean Physics and head of the Polar Ocean Physics Group at the Department of Applied Mathematics and Theoretical Physics at Cambridge University. He's also the former director of the Scott Polar Research Institute, and he's recognized and renowned in the field of Arctic region impact, meaning the impact of the climate and the rapid loss of polar ice. So you're going to hear him share some insights today that even for the most flippant will get your attention. Recently we had Professor Emeritus Guy McPherson on this program. Guy is one of about 14 climatologists who are willing to tell the truth irrespective of the consequences to their reputations. Now, if I told you that an awful lot of scientists know the truth, but not all of them are willing to tell you the full measure of that truth because they're afraid of, in essence, terrifying people. Because be realistic, how many people do you personally know who actively engaged in trying to do something constructive to lower global warming problems, such as going 100% vegan, being very conscious in your choices, contributing your energies or some resources to some of the good environmental groups, which I'll be mentioning today. So that's what we're up against. In my world, it is simple, and those of you who've been listening for any length of time know that. I simply tell it like it is. I don't sugarcoat anything. I don't believe we benefit from that. And especially for the millennials, there are some very conscientious millennials out there. You are going to be responsible for carrying forward what we, the baby boomers, as a generation, have. We are not addressing anything right now. We have failed. In fact, my new documentary is on this very topic about what the hell happened to my generation. Is there anything else we can screw up? And I threw a scorched earth approach on my generation because we're the screw-ups, we're the asses, we're the selfish narcissists, we're the creeps that caused our children to be spoiled rotten, whose children then became spoiled rotten, whose children become spoiled rotten. It's just crescendoing down. And rare is the person who will acknowledge that they're responsible for anything. Why? Because you participated in some, you know, anti-Vietnam War effort, or you spent a weekend at a commune, and or you shop at Whole Foods, or you get a colonic, that somehow you don't have to do anything else. Well, millennials, it's on you. Because if you don't do it, you're not going to have a planet that you can exist on. Wait till you hear my guest. I only bring on people who are going to tell it like it is, and it's going to upset a lot of people what you're going to hear, but you're going to hear it. And then at the end of the program, I don't know the person's name, it was anonymous, sent us a clip from an old party. Now, I've done about 50 parties. These are free dance parties just to celebrate life with people in this radio audience over the last 40 years. I don't know how long this was taken, it was 30 years ago. I don't know. But let's see if you can see yourself in it. Now, it's only going to be for people who are watching us on Facebook. It'll be at the very end, at the end of the program, when all the other stations sign off, and we have 5 minutes. We'll play it there. I'm guesstimating upwards of 50,000 people or more attended my parties. One party alone had 5,000 people. Another had 4,000 people. So we had 50 of these. And the venues were generally very large. So see if you can see yourself. And if you can, please email me your name. And if you know the year, let us know. I don't know the year. So let's begin, because we have a lot to share today. And it's a lot of serious stuff. But we always like to begin with the latest on health and healing. From the University of Texas, an article published in Precision Oncology shows that curcumin, which is cure, C-U-R, cumin, C-U-M-I-N, and resveratrol, trol, T-R-O-L. That's what you get from grapes. You can also get it from blueberries. And it's very powerful. You've heard me say many times, grapes are one of nature's most perfect foods. I consume grapes every single day, 7 days a week, and in large amounts. Now, unfortunately, we're not getting the benefit from seedless grapes as we do from seeded grapes. But a lot of people don't like to crunch the seeds, if they have dentures or they have problems with their gums, or they might have some diverticulitis and not be able to have it. But if you can have grape juice, that's terrific. Or any grape product that concentrates that in your body. Or if not, just take resveratrol by itself. The grape skin also has a lot of healing power. So how many studies are on resveratrol? Over 5,000 studies. You can go to PubMed yourself and type in resveratrol and health. And all these studies come up. We're just not made aware of them. And curcumin has even more studies. Cure, C-U-R, cumin, C-U-M-I-N. That's the active ingredient in turmeric, which is the yellow herb used in curry. But remember, eating turmeric is good, but only a small fraction of that is curcumin. Having curcumin as a separate isolate at like 500 milligrams, 1,000 milligrams, and if I'm counseling someone, if they have chronic fatigue syndrome, Lyme's disease, cancer, AIDS, I'll suggest real high doses, 6, 8, 10,000 milligrams. It's non-toxic, but boy, is it good. Turns off inflammation all over the body. Also, it turns off inflammation in the brain. It's great for people with Alzheimer's. Here's what they say it's also good for. Quote, by screening 142 phytochemicals in a natural compound library and testing various doses alone or in combination in human prostate cancer cell lines, researchers from the University of Texas at Austin identified curcumin from turmeric and resveratrol found in red grapes and other plants and ursolic acid, ursolic, U-R-S-O-L-I-C, which occurs in rosemary and apple peel. Ah, all of you who've been, as I suggest, peeling 4 apples. Don't throw away the rest of the apple. You can juice the rest of the apple. But here's the key. The skin of 4 apples, organic apples, put them in a blender, then put in some pomegranates, and you can use frozen if you can't get fresh, and blueberries, raspberries, and then some concentrates. Particularly very good would be grape concentrate and also a mulberry concentrate. And then blend that up and drink that down. It's a phenomenal stimulant for your intestine to turn off all forms of inflammation, your stomach, your esophagus. It's just terrific for you. But here they say it. So these compounds were found to help with prostate cancer. Natural, non-toxic. So there you are. Now, vitamin C, as we know, is just one of nature's most perfect items. Interesting, because I was coming out of an art film, and a person who was in the movie came over to me afterwards and said, "You won't remember me, but years and years ago, I brought a friend," and this happens to be a particularly very famous person, an artist, "who had an infection that wouldn't heal and was dying of it. And I gave him very high dose. It came up at night, 11 o'clock at night. And I called in the medical staff, and we worked overnight. And this guy got the highest doses of vitamin C I've ever given to any human being, even higher than people with AIDS. And I was able to reverse full-blown AIDS with, I work with 1,200 people with full-blown AIDS, one-on-one with me. Didn't charge a person. And with 12 of them, I said, "Are you willing to really go the whole way?" And of all these 1,200 people, 12 said yes. That meant that they were there 4 hours a day for 6 days a week. In 16 months, we reversed all AIDS. Tony Brown found out about it. Isn't it interesting? Now, think about this for a moment. This just came to me. We held a press conference to let people know there was a successful natural treatment for AIDS. We sent out 7,000 invitations. We hired a professional public relations firm. They did phone calls. They sent computer blasts. And so everyone got it. New York Times got it. In fact, I was being interviewed by the New York Post and told them, "Would you come to this, because you're going to meet medical doctors from all over the country, persons from all over the country who have all made major improvements or completely reversed their AIDS-defining illnesses. And these are none of these people started off as HIV positive but healthy. These were all people with very advanced conditions. And today they're all healthy. And 12 of them are from me, but all the rest come from, and they have their medical records, and we have a whole panel of people. Senator David Patterson, before he was governor, was on the panel, other professors at universities. Why? And they had 25,000 studies there. Why? Because let's say someone says, "Well, we used high doses intravenous vitamin C." Okay, someone's going to say, a journalist says, "Well, what proof do you have that vitamin C intravenous or oral is going to help someone with AIDS-defining illness?" They had all the studies, the peer-reviewed independent literature showing that everything used by these 100 persons in the room had a basis in good quality science. So we had a panel of scientists, professors, the scientific literature, a room full of doctors, and we put the word out everywhere. Not a single journalist showed up, not one. And yet at the same time, anyone who suggested alternative ways of approaching AIDS were attacked. "Oh, you're an AIDS denialist. How's that?" "Well, you're not telling people to take the drugs." Of course I'm not going to tell people to take the drugs. They can, their doctor can tell them, but I've done the research. You haven't on AZT. It's killing people by the thousands, the hundreds of thousands. And you're suggesting people take that? Shame on you. We're saving lives. Why don't you come and see how we're doing it? But guess which community did pick up on this? Bill Tatum, publisher of the Amsterdam News. Tony Brown, the most popular program at that time, syndicated on PBS, over 400 stations. Doug Henderson, a very proactive African-American journalist. Arthur Ashe, Stokely Carmichael, all these. I mean, dozens. You wouldn't know it because the mainstream media refused to touch the story. Tony Brown interviewed these people. He had an independent doctor interview, look at the medical records. Absolute proof we cured it. Isn't it amazing? Only in America could you cure an incurable condition, repeatedly do it, prove it, have the medical records, and the mainstream media will not pay attention to it. And if they interview you, they'll never accept what you've done as legitimate. That's why I'm telling you up front, don't trust the mainstream media. Don't trust the mainstream medical community to be honest and fair in what they do, because they can't. Money controls everything. And the drug companies that promote what treatments you should get, they're the ones controlling the politics, the media, on all things. So anyhow, here we had vitamin C, and it saved this person's life. Very famous person. And but a huge amounts. Now, here's what University of Salford Biomedical Research Center has to say. And it says, cancer stem cells, which fuel the growth of fatal tumors, can be knocked out by a 1-2 combination of antibiotics and vitamin C in a new experimental strategy published by the University of Salford in the United Kingdom. The antibiotics, doxycycline, followed by a dose of ascorbic acid, vitamin C, were surprisingly effective in killing the cancer stem cells under laboratory conditions, according to the research published in the peer-reviewed journal Oncotarget. Oncotarget is a very respected cancer journal. We were getting reversing stage 4 cancer 35 years ago. They're just finding out about it today. And it's not the antibiotic that's killing the cancer. Antibiotic's not going to kill cancer cells, but it's vitamin C. Now, if they did this study with just vitamin C, they'd have come up with even better results. So I just want you to know, vitamin C and cancer. So here's the logic behind that. If vitamin C is able to, along with an antibiotic, in that their study, to kill vitamin C, why wouldn't it make common sense to use vitamin C prophylactically, meaning preventatively every day, to prevent the cancer in the first place? It makes sense. What's the one thing that all the diets around the country, Brian Clements down at Hippocrates, he's doing good work. Brian's always done good work. The Charlotte Gerson out in California with the Gerson diet, it's a good anti-cancer diet. There are people using a good anti-cancer diet. They're doing it to reverse cancer. Well, it doesn't make sense if that's the diet that reverses it, that's the diet that will prevent it. So you don't need to be a scientist to figure out if you eat healthy, you have healthy thoughts, and you support your body's immune system, then there's no reason that you should be susceptible. Now, here's the University of Southern California. And it's an article published in the peer-reviewed journal eNeuro. Quote, a diet high in cholesterol, fat, and sugar may influence the development of Alzheimer's disease in people who carry the APOE4 gene, a leading risk factor for the memory-erasing disease Alzheimer's. In this study, published in the current journal of eNeuro, it's the latest to explore the association between obesity and Alzheimer's disease, both of which are associated with inflammation and both of which affect millions of people. And they found here that it was the people who had overweight conditions that were far more susceptible. I've been saying this for so long. How many times have you heard me say, you cannot be overweight and healthy? It is not scientifically or humanly possible. And yet the same people who told you drink alcohol, it's good for you, now are shown to be completely wrong. Well, how many people died of liver cirrhosis? How many people died of cardiomyopathy? How many people died of enzyme elevation in the liver because they were drinking every day? When you're wrong and people die, it's a serious situation. And they take no responsibility. So what I'm saying is we should have a national program on explaining the true causes of being overweight and then what should be the healthy diet that help people lose that weight. If we really love people and care about their health, then we should commit ourselves to sharing this information. Now, if a person doesn't want the information, respect that. Not everybody wants the information. Not everybody has the mindset at this particular time in their life to make healthy, positive choices. And that's okay. That's their right. But we have the opportunity to engage. If someone says, yeah, I'd like to know how I could lose this weight and get back my health, you bet. A plant-based diet does it. All right? I was going to have a premiere for Plant Codes, but I waited half a year and no one at my sister station, BAI, seems to want to go forward with that. So I'm just going to do it free over the internet. I'll give everyone a date. It'll be in the next 2 weeks where you can watch what could be one of the most important films of your life. It's gaining a lot of popularity. It's the most winning documentary that I'm aware of in the world right now. And you haven't seen the doctors in here. You haven't seen the patients. Really new. And it's a positive, upbeat, happy message. So if you're having trouble losing weight, if you're having trouble with not having a good support system, stay tuned because we're going to help you. We're going to help everyone. Oh, and by the way, here's one more before we take a break. This is from the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, a good group, by the way. And this was published in the Journal of the American College of Nutrition. A plant-based diet boosts weight loss twice as effectively as traditional diabetic diets. Therefore, if you're diabetic, if you're pre-diabetic, if you're overweight, you're going to have an elevated blood pressure, elevated cholesterol, elevated C-reactive protein, elevated homocysteine, elevated fibrinogen level, all of which put you at risk of heart attack, stroke, or cancer. You're also at greater risk of depression. So a plant-based diet can help you lose the weight and keep it off, and get you healthy in the process. I'll do a great deal more on this. In fact, what I'll do is I'll probably do a classroom on the air. So every week we'll do like a health support group on the air, and I'll show you how to walk you through that. That's the latest on health and nutrition. We're not going to go to a break immediately because yesterday on our some stations, we played what I thought would be a very important interview from our Progressive Commentary Hour. I do the Progressive Commentary Hour every Tuesday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. It's always on one theme. It's very serious. It's a hard-hitting theme with guests that we have screened who are going to tell you the truth. We never do it based upon a person's ideology. We base upon what's the problem, what are the solutions. And it was very important about our economy and how we're being lied to. Now, I hope you heard it. I hope you heard what they had to say. I have a part two coming where I'm going to do a commentary on it's right in front of us and we're not seeing it. It's everywhere and we're not aware of it. The income disparity and what's causing it and how can we change it and how can we correct it without going through Washington, D.C., which will never happen. So that's coming at you. But anyhow, on a Progressive Radio Network, I had a woman call in. I had not pre-interviewed her. Her name's Carmen. And she was a little nervous. And every week I'm going to have a different person on who has made changes in their life, who has followed protocol very, not haphazardly, 100%, 120%, and has taken a medically irreversible condition and reversed it. And if I'm sharing this with you, as we did with Kenny last week, who reversed completely 100% multiple sclerosis and independently confirmed by two different neurologists and MRIs and all the blood workup he did. Because if you know someone who is sick, who's suffering, then at least it will give you hope. And everything has to start with hope and a positive mindset. If your doctor says, I'm sorry, you know, there's nothing more we can do, we would suggest hospice care and we'll give you some opioids to kill the pain, then immediately your whole energy shifts into a dying mode. Hopelessness, helplessness, loss. That's extremely destructive. And all healing comes through being positive. You can't heal if you're negative. So I wanted her to have a chance to speak with the other stations that didn't hear her yesterday. So she's back today. Her name is Carmen, and with her on the phone is Luann Panessi. Nice to have you back, Carmen.
Hi, how are you? And thank you so much for giving me hope and happiness.
Carmen, we don't have a lot of time before the break, but could you please do this? Could you tell people what your original diagnosis was?
I was diagnosed with lung cancer, stage 4, metastasized to the brain and several parts of my body, including my lymph nodes, in my chest, my spinal cord, my right hip. And at this point, it's totally gone. Nothing shows anywhere. No cancer cells, no nothing. I have followed the protocol, and it has been the most amazing experience. I see people losing hope, and I'm trying to give hope out here because you guys have given me hope to keep continuing.
And when was your original diagnosis?
That was September of 2016.
Okay, so it's
last year.
Last year. Mm-hmm. I took the time after yesterday afternoon to look in the medical literature. I can find no case on record where anyone with stage 4, which is end stage, terminal, lung cancer metastasized to the brain, to the spine, to the breast, to the liver, the pancreas, and the liver. I can find no one's ever survived that. If anyone can find that someone survived it, I'd like to see it. And you did it without the medicines. You did it without the orthodoxy. And yet you had your medical doctors, your oncologist last week do all the CAT scans and all the tests to determine this. What do you feel you can do now that you are cancer-free, to help the other people, the men and women in this society who believes there's only one approach to cancer treatment, and you know now, and you have a truth, your individual truth, and that didn't happen overnight. And it wouldn't have happened had you not given 100%. So what can you do now to help other people?
Well, I told my story and my experience with your help and Luan's help, because I didn't know about you. I have never heard your name, and I first met you at the retreat. And honestly, I can say the happiness that I have in my heart, if I was able to show it physically, people would think I'm crazy, and I think I look crazy at this point. But telling people, you know, what to do, not to keep believing everything they hear. They have to follow, you know, their heart and fight for it, because this life is given to us, and we have to take care of it. And you guys are giving me the hope to do that, to, you know, to face reality. It's been an awakening, actually, to be able to work with you guys and follow your protocols, you know, work with Luan. Luan, she's an angel. I think that's the wonders I talk to people about. You know, I have a friend who's going through something similar. Her mom got the same brain surgery I had, and she's so desperate. And I've been trying to, you know, feed that hope to them that they can fight. They don't have to give up. People don't have to give up. If you do, you know, if you follow through and you do the right thing and you eat healthy and you do the plant-based diet and your nutrients and work out and go out there and face life, you know, with that wonderful faith that we have, beautiful faith that it was given to us.
By the way,
we can do this.
The good news is that one of the people who joined you, I don't know if you remember or not, a woman who's an oncologist, worked at Sloan Kettering, she is going to be in touch with you because she wants to take the next step in her own career. Her and her husband, both board certified physicians. I don't know if you remember them or not. They were there, and she's now going to start looking at what's been missing in her orthodox medical training and protocols to take this to another level, because you weren't the only one. If you remember, there were five other people who were terminal, and they're not now.
Yeah.
So thank you for coming on and just sharing so that the people in this audience
know
that there are other approaches, and whether they're denigrated or dismissed as nonsense, you're living proof of that. And so don't ever let anyone talk you into disbelieving in your reality. Okay, Carmen?
I will not allow that. And thank you so much, guys. Thank you for being in my life. Thank you for making the difference to me.
Good. That's Carmen. And we will, for those of you who want to speak with Carmen, we'll speak to her. And if they're physicians, nurses, or people, not curiosity seekers, legitimate people, and they'll be filtered to make sure they're legitimate through Luann, then you can talk with Carmen, as we had people talk with Kenny. And each week we'll bring someone else on. Since returning after 5.5 weeks of being on the, the road filming and also doing the retreat, I am inundated with terminally ill people. You have no idea how many people I'm counseling each day. So please, people who have other non-fatal conditions, non-terminal conditions, I won't be able to see you. It's just not humanly possible. As it is, I've got a 4 or 5 month waiting list. But I'm going to give you the name and phone number of one person who's highly qualified who can help non-terminal people. Her name is Celeste. I'll give you her number. It's 917-392-2227. 917-392-2227. And I'll probably have to hire a couple more people just to help all the other people who have conditions, but who I can only help people who are terminal. And then I got to catch up. Now, we're just extending our program for the Facebook for just another moment because Luann is on the phone too. And Luann, I called you yesterday afternoon and put you on the phone with someone I just met on the street. And she came over to me and it was not to talk about cancer. It had to do with something else. And I asked her, she said, oh, she listens to radio all the time. And I said, did you hear Carmen Day? She said, no, I didn't listen today. So I asked her to download the show and so she could hear about Carmen. And she has stage 4 cancer. And the treatment is 80 treatments with a particular drug at $20,000 a treatment. That's 80 times 20,000. 80 times 20,000 is 1.6 million. Who in the world has that kind of money? Who could afford to be treated even if the therapy works? And I said, did you actually look in the peer-reviewed literature to see whether or not that therapy works? Don't trust the physician. Don't trust the hospital. Don't trust the drug company. Look to see if there's actual good science showing that if you give that kind of money and you're in that therapy, you have a legitimate chance of survival. And if you do, good. But then who's going to pay for it? I just find that obscene that the people are exploiting people's diseases to that extent. Now, you were head of nursing at Long Island Jewish Hospital for 18 years. You had over 100 nurses under you, saw every patient that came in. You knew every doctor there. And you also had a background in oncology and emergency medicine. Have you seen there's been any major improvement in survival or treatment of most organic cancers, solid cancers, in the last 20 years?
Not at all. Not at all, Gary. Not one scintilla. And I'll tell you why. Because the attitude, the approach that we take, is that cancer is something that we have to fight. Just like the Middle East. Any place, anything that we're concerned about, we feel we've got to blow it up. We've got to destroy it. Instead, in integrative medicine, we look at healing the body. Completely different mindset, completely different protocol. All we do in conventional medicine, Gary, is we poison you with chemotherapy. So we're not only destroying your cancer cells, we're destroying healthy cells. And the crapshoot is the cancer cells won't grow back. Well, the cancer cells are your own cells with a very distorted DNA from free radical damage, other factors. So there's a pretty good chance they're going to grow back. Will a tumor shrink? Absolutely it will shrink. Will it reverse cancer? No, because once the chemo is over, the body is going to start regenerating its multiplying cells along with the tumor cells. Either that or we burn you. We put radiation in you, which leaves terrible scarring, whether it's in your brain, in your lungs, in your liver, wherever. And the other thing we do is we cut you. Now, I'm not opposed to surgical intervention if it's going to debulk a tumor. I'm all for that, as long as someone is on the backside starting a whole new lifestyle. Because in medicine, whether it's general medicine or whether it's oncology medicine, you know, it's a big guessing game, but the bottom line is money. We've got to make money and we've got to stay in control. So we put the fear of God in you that if you don't do our therapy, you're going to die an untimely and painful death. And people, unfortunately, are more motivated by fear than they are seeking happiness.
Luann, so, we're going to have to continue this conversation because I have my guest on hold here, and we've got him on Skype, Professor Peter Wadham, who's going to talk about the environment in ways people have not heard before. And he's a heavyweight in the field, highly respected, but he will not compromise on saying what he knows. In any case, I'm glad that you also don't compromise on saying what you know. Give your number out if anyone wants to speak with you. Otherwise, we'll be flooded with calls here today, and I can't take any calls.
Sure. My number here is 903-881-7008. That's 903-881-7008.
Because coming up in the near future, I'd like to do an entire progressive commentary hour, a full hour, on you talking about your experience as running the hospital over there and then what you've learned from since then and about that. Luann Panessi, thank you. We're going to take a break. Before we do, James Irsay, I was speaking with him the other day, and he was celebrating his mother's 100th birthday. She's just as sharp as she can be and loves music. She was a big Paul Robeson fan. And so, Evelyn Irsay, congratulations and all the best on reaching 100. Much more to go. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Now we go to Skype to meet with Professor Peter Wadham. He is a professor of ocean physics and head of the Polar Ocean Physics Group at the Department of Applied Mathematics and Theoretical Physics at Cambridge University. I gave you his background a little earlier. He is also the author of A Farewell to Ice, which is a frontline report from the world leader and outlines his dire warnings about the ice-free world in the event humanity fails to meet challenges. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you very much. I'm pleased to be here.
There's a contention and a debate over whether the Arctic ice is warming or cooling, and you've been at the center of the debate for a long time, and warming of some of the potential worst cases of scenarios, especially when all the Arctic ice is lost forever throughout the year. And the Arctic, like everywhere else on the Earth, goes through periods of warming and cooling. So far this year, it's turning to be on the hottest on records, and March broke heat records, followed by April breaking again more records, and now we're breaking even more records in June. And earlier this year, the World Meteorological Organization stated that the increased record-breaking heat waves is pushing the planet into, quote, uncharted territory. So we wish to focus primarily on your primary expertise, which is the Arctic and polar ice. So please present your argument for us to be especially worried that not just the heat waves, but also the melting of the Arctic ice is pushing our planet into uncharted territory as well. The forum is yours.
Yes. Well, that's absolutely true. The last 3 years have been, each one has been the warmest on record for average global air temperatures. And in each of these years, the Arctic ice volume has reduced even more. So what we're looking at is a volume which is now in the summer a quarter of what it was 30 years ago. So we've seen a massive decrease in both the area and the thickness of Arctic ice. So it's now heading towards a point at which it will all vanish at least for a month or so in the summer, and then that ice-free period will gradually grow until we get several months that are ice-free. And this looks at first as if it's just a consequence of global warming. The atmosphere is getting warmer, the ice is getting thinner, and it's disappearing. But So it looks like just an interesting phenomenon. But the trouble is that when the ice disappears from the Arctic, it produces a whole load of feedbacks, a whole load of other impacts, which actually have a very much larger effect on global climate than simply the disappearance of the ice. So that's the thing which I warn about, really, in my book, is the fact that it's not just the ice shrinking that's important, but the consequences of that. One of them is that the planet, the albedo of the planet changes. The planet becomes darker because it's absorbing more radiation and not reflecting as much out, because you're taking away white surface and replacing it with dark. So that accelerates global warming as a whole. Another consequence is that because the ice is gone from around Greenland, the continent of Greenland warms up much more, and you can start to get melting of the Greenland ice cap. This is something that wasn't noticed until about 20 years ago. Then it's got more and more each year. You're getting melt of the surface of the ice cap, and a lot of water is flowing off into the ocean. And that's then increasing the rate of global sea level rise. So global sea level rise is now largely determined by the melt of the Greenland ice cap rather than warming of the water or melt of other glaciers. And so that's a second effect. And then a third big one that we really should worry about is the fact that if you look along the shallow waters north of Siberia, the continental shelves, you find a huge area there of very shallow water, only 50 to 100 meters deep, in which you have a massive amount of methane in sediments underneath the water, but held in place by the fact that you have permafrost offshore. That's permafrost that extends out from the shoreline. You have permafrost on land normally. This extends out to sea and acts as a kind of cap protecting us from the methane that lies underneath. But this cap is thawing because as the sea ice retreats, the ocean water warms up, the permafrost melts, the methane can escape. And it's already escaping in very large plumes of methane bubbles appearing in all of these shelf seas in the summer. Now, if that gets worse, that could really have a very rapid impact on our global climate, because methane is a very, very powerful greenhouse gas. So we have a set of effects which amplify the retreat of the sea ice itself and give us something far worse. The final one of those, I think scientists are pretty sure about those three, but the final one, there's some discussion about what causes it, but we're finding in the last 6 or 7 years extreme weather events going on in the Northern Hemisphere, either extreme heat or extreme cold, extreme something. And one of the mechanisms to explain that is that the jet stream, which is the air mass that separates polar air from subtropical air, that jet stream has slowed down and is going in big lobes now instead of in a straight line. And this brings cold air down to latitudes that are too low for it to be, and brings warm air up into latitudes that are too high for it to be. So instead of having a clear separation between polar and tropical air, we're getting tropical air moving through these lobes into places where it shouldn't get to, and polar air coming down into places it shouldn't get to. This really upsets mid-latitude weather, and that means mid-latitude crop production. And most of the world's crops are grown in mid-latitudes of the Northern Hemisphere. So we have a threat there that may or may not be due to the warming of the Arctic and the loss of sea ice, but it's certainly a clear new pattern of weather occurring, which is disrupting food production. So all of these things put together make one feel that one needs to sound the alarm on the retreat of sea ice. It's not something we should just accept as an interesting change. It's a change which itself provokes other changes which are very detrimental to our future as a planet.
I'd like to bring up just one of the feedback loops that you discussed and put it into the kind of vernacular the average person could understand. Here you have the solar, let's say the sun shining down hits the ice that's in the Arctic or the side of a mountain, bounces back harmlessly into the atmosphere. When it heats up to the degree it is now and continues, it melts all that. Then it goes into a relatively shallow Arctic, and then that opens up the Arctic to thawing of the ground at the bottom. And in some places, the Arctic is 300 feet to 500 feet deep. It's not that deep. And so that methane begins to come up. And normally, normal amounts of methane coming up would not be a big problem, but you're talking about mega amounts of methane. Yeah. And then one of the largest areas, boreal forests in the world, across the northern hemisphere and through Russia and Norway and Canada, that has methane trapped for thousands of years. That begins to rise up. And then you have a real serious problem because now you got a feedback loop where it gets so hot as the temperature rises in places like Kansas, North Dakota, where they grow grains, they're going to have more difficult time growing grains because at a certain temperature, it gets too hot and the grain won't germinate. And if it germinates and then it's suddenly flooded because of excessive flooding that they wouldn't have had. For example, just in the last week, you said extreme weather events. We had an extreme weather event in Texas where they had 10 inches of rain. In under 24 hours, it broke a record. And even in Florida, I have my home in Florida, and it was the most torrential rain they've ever experienced in one week in the state, and people just weren't prepared for it. So these are feedback loops. So you could realistically, not theoretically, you could end up having a lot of the grain that normally is grown and fed to people, and the number one item is grain. And it's limited, at least limited in those areas where it's too hot. Is that a realistic analysis?
Oh, it is very much. Yes, I mean, one of the reasons why in the Paris Agreement, the world agreed to try to keep warming to less than 2 degrees above the pre-industrial level is that when you go beyond that, it really does upset grain production. The yield of nearly every type of grain decreases with a warming of more than 2 degrees. So you've got the weather event disrupts food production anyway in the ways that you've described, the effects of storms and extreme heat on crops. But then there's a steady effect, which is that if the global temperatures rise more than 2 degrees, there'll be a big falling off of overall food production just because of the fact that the average temperature has risen. And that's the big fear, because global population is rising very rapidly and it stayed ahead of food production just about. But food production, sorry, has kept up with it just about. But we're getting to the point where the population growth is uncontrolled and the food production is threatened, so that there could be a yawning gap opening up.
In fact, Chelsea Harvey in the Washington Post has an article that's entitled "A Climate Change Reaction: Major Greenland Melting Could Devastate Crops in Africa." Now, we already know that most of Africa is water deprived, and we also know that they're having great famine there, and yet there's no place for over 150 million food and weather refugees to go. No one's planned on it. We're not even able to handle political refugees from Syria and Libya and Mali and some other places. So this is a whole tsunami of human suffering that no one is planning on, no one is prepared for. How are you going to feed them? Where are you going to put them? Because you just can't have the desertification of the Middle East and Africa without consequences. There's human consequences here. Also today, from U.S. environmental correspondent Susanna Goldberg, quote, climate change is set to make America hotter, drier, and more disaster-prone. Draft from the NCA makes clear link between climate change and extreme weather as groups urge people to take action, the president take action, and no one's taking action. Obama didn't take action. He had this nice way of making it sound like, yes, we're all in on dealing with the climate, but then at the same time, nothing was pushed to reduce the impact, and especially the impact of methane. In fact, there is a climatologist who has done a lot of work on this, one of the world's leading, Dr. Natalia Sarkovo of the University of Alaska. Researchers warned about the methane release from the northern tundra and permafrost, but there's also enormous amounts of methane under the Arctic Ocean and the ice, and that's being released with global warming. So we're in a lot of problem here, and the point is we're not doing anything at our nation. Other nations are making some attempts, but it's way too slow. People are still focused upon consuming. People are still focused upon their meat-based animal protein diet. People are focused upon buying stuff they don't need and creating lots more pollution and lots more CO and CO2 and a lot more methane. So everyone, if you ask, do you want it to get hotter? No. Do you want the world to be in a cataclysmic position? No. What are you doing about it? Nothing. So I'm seeing this kind of hypocrisy and hubris that's at work here. And I believe that a lot of scientists are not being completely honest about how bad it will get. Your thoughts on these issues, please.
Yes, I agree with you completely. Firstly, on the Africa question, the United Nations Population Program produced a prediction of what populations of different parts of the world will be by 2100. And most parts of the world would be increasing by about 30%, which is just about containable. And Europe, in fact, going down in population. But Africa going up from 1.1 billion to 4.3 billion. In other words, quadrupling its population. So every part of the world is showing a population increase of a tolerable level, except Africa. And in Africa, it's set to quadruple. It's already a continent where we can't feed everybody. And instead of 1.1 billion people that need feeding, there'll be 4.4 billion people that need feeding. And nobody has thought about this. All of the complaints in Europe, for instance, about economic migrants from Africa trying to get across the Mediterranean and come to Europe, that's just a sort of a tip of the iceberg compared to the number who would want to come or would desperately need to come because there's no food. And the need to feed them is already something which has been taken on board but not actually enacted. The United States, for instance, has a food program in which food aid is available, or there's a big kind of mountain of food, or was, for famines in Africa, and that was largely maize or corn, as it's called in America, and yet that mountain has diminished to almost nothing because a large amount of that corn is now turned into biofuel instead of being used as food and sent to Africa. So things are getting actually worse rather than better in terms of coping with that. Then in terms of all the other changes, the methane one is you're right in talking about dishonesty, because the body that is most trusted for climate change studies, that's the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, has really soft-pedaled on the methane threat. They admit that there is a large methane threat, but you can divide the methane threat into two. One is this vast area of permafrost on land. That's about half the area of Asia and a large part of northern North America is underlain by permafrost. That permafrost will gradually melt because as the climate warms, you get a kind of mulch from the vegetable matter that's released from the ice. That chemistry then happens to that, and you get methane produced as well as carbon dioxide and some other greenhouse gases as well. But it's a slow process, or relatively slow. But it's inexorable, and by the end of the century, we'll have about 30 or 40 gigatons of methane released from that. But you have an equal amount can be released within less than a decade from the thawing of the permafrost offshore, because there the methane is already there. It was formed in an earlier glacial episode. You've got a 1,000 meters of sediment all full of methane hydrates held in place by this thin cap of offshore permafrost, which is melting away because the water's warming up. And as soon as that cap has gone, that methane is going to come out, and it's already coming out to some extent. But if it comes out in a big pulse, then we did a calculation that this could cause an immediate warming of 0.6 of a degree in the planet, which is nearly as much as the warming we've had since the 19th century. So this would be, it would be a rapid pulse, because methane acts quickly and then then gets oxidized, so its effect is only lasts for about a decade. But for a decade, we'll have a massive warming of the whole planet. And so that should be something that we guard against. We try to find ways in which we can maybe tap off that methane before it comes out into the atmosphere. It should be a major concern of the world.
It isn't.
Methane, but it's not.
It's not. What I'd like to do is this. I'd like to invite you back for a full hour on our Progressive Commentary Hour, because I didn't even get into Antarctica and the Larsen C Shelf and other things that I have to ask you. So if you could find it in your schedule to allow us an opportunity to speak with you for an hour, we could get a lot more information shared with this audience.
Certainly, I'd be happy to, and hopefully I can get my Skype to work next time as well.
That's fine. It's called A Farewell to Ice. My guest, Professor Peter Wadham, W-A-D-H-A-M, from Cambridge University, and also the Polar Ocean Physics Group at the Department of Applied Mathematics and Theoretical Physics at Cambridge University. Thank you very much for being with us. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening, and now we'll finish off by showing you, well, hopefully you'll see yourself in here. Someone took it. I don't know who it was. Just a fun dance party we had a long time ago.